Welcome to the Repair Ed podcast, where we reflect on education and reimagine equitable futures. I'm Claire Neves, a researcher who worked in education in the city of Bristol in the southwest of England for over 15 years. In each episode, I'll talk to educators and thinkers about current injustices in our schooling system and their ideas for creating fairer educational futures. This podcast forms part of Repair Ed, a five-year project funded by UKRI to examine educational inequality in Bristol's primary schools. Welcome to another episode of the Repair Ed podcast. My guest today is Jodie Clark, an autism specialist and consultant, trainer and speaker. Hi, Jodie.
Hi.
Could you tell us a bit more about yourself and how your work relates to education?
Try and keep it brief. So yeah, I'm an autism specialist, and I am a late recognised autistic and ADHD myself, and also a parent to three neurodivergent children, which I always add in because I feel it's really important, certainly when I'm working with families, training, speaking, that people are aware that I wear several hats. So all of my work, all of my training, all of my support is based not only on personal experience of parenting, but personal experience of living as a neurodivergent person, but as well as sort of my academic theory-based, knowledge-based, hate the word qualification, but I've also got that sort of academic background as well. So I bring all three hats into my work. My work's like constantly evolving, really. So my work started off very much as a frontline practitioner, working with directly with children and young people, mentoring, supporting families and parenting, to sort of an advocacy around getting needs met. Now, obviously, that's always fallen into education, and a lot of the advocacy around EHCPs and needs assessments, and just working alongside children, young people, their families to really gain a really accurate, valuable insight into what it is they need in order to thrive, particularly in education. And that's always informed all of my reports that then inform EHCPs. My work has sort of slightly developed in that I'm doing a lot more training and speaking now, which for me feels really, really positive, because for a long time, particularly in my own sort of clinical supervision, I was like, there's so many families that need support and I really wish I could do more. So now if I go in and I train a school, or I speak to a group of professionals such as educational psychologists or CAMS practitioners, I feel like, okay, I'm hopefully making a difference for more children, more young people, more families. It's quite varied my role, which is really, really nice. I still really value my direct on the ground frontline practitioner work, and I still do work directly with families, just a smaller number really, but that's really important for me because every single family I meet, every single child or young person I meet has had a different experience, have a different, you know, experience of the world and how they process the world, and I think that's a really, really important thing, is that I can't tell the story for all autistic people, I can't tell the story for all autistic children, because, you know, I hate it when people say that they're an expert in autism. Like, I'm not. I can't be an expert in every person's individual experience. So all of my work is completely bespoke, and it's completely child and family led. And that's that's something that I try to preach a lot about, is that we have to really, really stay child-centered, young person-centered. And unfortunately, I think our education system has massively lost sight of that through the various different pressures and tick boxing and policies and crowd control. Unfortunately, again, in terms of my link with education and why I talk about schools quite a lot, most of the young people I work with have hit a level of mental health crisis and high levels of autistic burnout. There's not enough research in that area at the moment. What we do know anecdotally and from one very good non-published research paper is we've got all of these children and young people that are school refusing, and I'm sort of doing little inverted commas there because I hate that term. So I work with a lot of children who are unable to attend school and have significant school trauma and burnout as a result of school. And my ADHD head has just stopped that track, and now I don't know where I was going with that. But essentially what I see all of the time is children being harmed by our education system. And when I say that in certain circles or circumstances or environments, I'm looked at like I must be absolutely crazy, because how on earth can this place of nurture, care, where, you know, everybody believes that this is the best, not everybody, but that this is the best place for our children to be, in government, you know, particularly during COVID, we're all about getting bums back on seats, and even still now, this massive drive for attendance. I said it to a paediatrician a year or so ago, maybe longer. I talked about a young person having school trauma, and they were a medical paediatrician in A&E, and they were like, what do you mean school trauma? And I was like, well, they have trauma from school. And it was just like I was speaking another language, because there's still this massive blind spot of understanding that actually, and this isn't me school blaming or teacher blaming, I'm talking about the institution as a whole, there are so many aspects of our education system that are not only not conducive to neurodivergent neurology, but for some young people, immensely harmful.
Yeah, so let's get into that a bit, because our project at this podcast looks at educational injustice, and you know, we will absolutely not shy away from using the word harm when it comes to school and the schooling system, and like you said, that's not to put the blame on teachers and schools, but it's looking at the systems and, you know, the way things are set up. And I think, you know, one of the things that I think, having been a Senko for, you know, many years in my previous career, was you can't talk about injustice in education without talking about special educational needs and disabilities. So, could you give a brief outline of some of the ways in which the system is unjust for pupils with special educational needs?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much, I'll try and keep it brief. Mm-hmm. There's so much in the environment. So one of the things that I'm really fortunate and privileged that one of my supervisors is Dr. Luke Bearden, and he has coined the golden equation, autism plus environment equals outcome. And the environment is like our main focus. What is going on within an environment that isn't leading to positive outcomes for our children and young people? And the environment, there is so much that falls into that environment box. So on a sort of umbrella scale, we've got policy, and we've got, and this is where my brain sort of fails me slightly, because I'm not one that can soak up statistics and policies and lots of government writing. That's not where my skills sit. But on a very basic level, just the policies that we're seeing in schools around attendance, uniform, behaviour, are all immensely ableist. It's come up again for me in the last week with this heat wave, where parents are awaiting emails from schools to tell us whether or not they're allowed to remove their blazers. Mm. When there's no autonomy for our young people to make good choices and trust what their bodies are telling them, and the repercussions of that are massive, particularly if you're an autistic student who, you know, feels and senses not only just uniform in a different way, but particularly heat intolerance and all of that sort of stuff. Attendance policies, and this is another thing I talk about a lot, our attendance policies insist on 100% attendance. As an autistic adult, I cannot physically work full time. I'm massively privileged in that I'm self-employed, and I work in a way that allows me to energy account. Now, if I go into schools, and I do quite regularly go into schools, either to deliver training or sometimes just sitting in a classroom to observe a child or young person, those environments are so demand heavy. They are so demand heavy from a sensory perspective, from an executive functioning perspective, from a social perspective, that expecting our autistic children and young people to be in school 100% of the time is not conducive to their learning or their mental health. So our attendance policies do not take into account how difficult, challenging, hostile the environment can be for so many of our neurodivergent students. Yet there's this massive drive, and I'm constantly talking about attendance in my training and when I'm supporting parents. And, you know, we are thriving for 100% attendance for our kids. And yes, some of them are managing 100% attendance. But what I'm quite commonly seeing outside of that is social burnout or a level of burnout that means after school, during the holidays, at weekends, those kids aren't able to manage play dates with friends, kicking the football around the park, family days out to the zoo, holidays. They, all of their time outside of school is recovery and recharge. And some of the older young people that I work with who've hit burnout in secondary years, when we look back over their educational careers, they realise that they were putting so much energy into surviving the school day every single day that actually they missed out on childhoods. You know, I'm working with teenagers who missed out on getting the bus into town on a weekend. And these, maybe to government, maybe to some people, these things don't seem important, but for our child development and for our feeling of belongingness with families and belongingness with peers, like, those things are really significant and are really, really important.
And yeah, a couple of things strike me there. Like, firstly, it's strange that that's not obvious, because if you speak to any teacher, they'll talk about this cycle of burnout in themselves, right? You know, I experienced it as a teacher. So you are literally kind of getting through until the holidays and then you just crash. I was always ill in the school holidays. So you'd expect teachers to be able to see that would be, you know, have such a big impact on autistic pupils. And the other thing is just this question around, you know, what is education for? And, you know, you're absolutely right to mention those social skills outside of school, which not only are kind of holistically really, really important because, you know, we want young people to develop those skills. But if you look at the EHCPs that a lot of these children will have, they'll actually have, you know, things around friendship and preparation for adulthood and, you know, travel independence and all those things on them. So it's almost like we're preventing autistic children from meeting their goals by expecting what everyone else is expected to do in school.
Yeah. And yeah, completely that. And on top of that, you've got also these levels of exhaustion and burnout, which then, you know, in school trauma and everything else, that compounds all of that. You know, not only, you know, they're not given access to it at the time, and then when it does come to the time, where they're out of the education system, they're just too exhausted and traumatized to manage the world. It's just really hard. Like, I work with some incredible schools, and I can think of one school in particular that I've spent a lot of time at, and who, it's a primary school, and they've got two incredible Senkos, and I'll go and spend like a couple of days with them doing various different things. And they took me into a reception class, and it was, I don't want to use the word chaos because there's negative associations with that, but the level of need in that class, and, you know, I said, how come you've got this child here? Like, this is, I think, what this child needs, blah, 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 blah. Really, they need a specialist setting. How come they've ended up with you? Well, you know, we've met them and we told the LA they need a specialist setting, but there isn't a specialist setting. So we've been told we have to have him in our environment. And I said, that's not safe. It's not safe for him. When I talk about safety, I don't mean about just about physical safety, but emotional safety, sensory safety, relational safety. Like, nobody's got there's no resource to keep him safe. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. And this is a school that are doing so much work with their staff, with their parents, with their children, with their students, and yet they are also in a position where the powers that be, as I call them, are insisting on situations which, yeah, aren't safe.
And that's something that I recognise a lot, you know, from my time in schools. The, you know, the recognition by pretty much everyone that mainstream is not the right setting for a particular child, but there just being no option because there isn't a special school place available.
Yeah. A big part of what I used to do was advocacy. So I would quite often, I'd spend a lot of time meeting families, meeting young people and doing EHCP needs assessments. These were always either me doing them free of charge or parents having to privately fund, because I'm independent and don't work within a local authority. And the hardest thing for me was I've got to a point now where I do less and less reports because I'm saying to families, look, I can come and meet you and I can meet your child and we can, you know, collaboratively put together a plan of need, but I cannot guarantee you that that report will then be followed and accepted. Even if it is accepted by your LA and they put the recommendations in the EHCP, I still then can't guarantee that that will actually mean a difference for your child day to day because there's not enough money, there's not enough resource. I will quite often say to families now, come back to me when you get to tribunal level, because I know in a court of law, because I am suitably qualified, my report will stand up in a court of law. So I've got to the point where I'm like, look, let's not spend the time and the money now. Let's wait until the next stage. It's like, oh, I was going to swear then. It's awful. It's awful to have to say that to families. I've taken a massive step back from advocacy. And, you know, I used to attend a lot of meetings with local authorities advocating for kids, particularly when I'd been working with them long term and I knew them really, really well. I've stepped back from that massively for my own self-preservation. I've had to fight for my own children and had to attend, you know, two tribunals for my own children. I've been exposed to the parent blame and all of that that comes from being a parent of neurodivergent kids, which is potentially a different subject altogether. But we, you know, just been posting to a parent actually this morning. Parents are being traumatized by the SEN system. And again, for people who haven't experienced that or don't have insight into that world, that might sound really dramatic, but it's genuinely not. It's incredibly traumatizing to be sat there knowing exactly what your child needs as a parent and a professional. And that actually some of these things aren't rocket science and some of these things aren't expensive, but that there's this barrier that's, or it feels so much like, and I think lots of people will relate to this, it feels so much like the whole square peg round hole analogy. Like, actually, yeah, we know that what you're asking for probably isn't, you know, it's definitely not unjustified, but actually it doesn't quite fit with our system. And I think this is me going all over the place, but I think a big thing for me as well is that, okay, there are needs of SEN, autistic, neurodivergent young people that always need to be very, very bespoke to them. But there are also massive elements of our education system that need changing and could make a massive difference to our EHCP kids. In my opinion, would make a massive difference to all kids, not just the SEN kids, but I have this belief that actually our education system is causing a lot of the issues that we're seeing in our kids as a whole, all of our kids. You know, we know from the various different Young Minds research and that we've got some of the most mentally unwell kids that we've ever had. And everyone wants to blame parents or COVID or social media. But it frustrates me that nobody is looking at, well, nobody in power is looking at our education system, particularly when, you know, recent reports that have come out. And again, I've not got a brain to remember numbers and stats, but our retention of teachers is so poor. And when teachers have been asked why, they're saying because the pressure is too much, the tick boxing is too much, the workload is too much. So people seem to be accepting that our teachers aren't able to thrive within the education system because of the workload. But why is nobody putting that next to what's happening to all of our kids? And it's for me, the education system is an ever increasing pressure pot.
Yeah.
We've got this push all of the time from government to progress, progress, progress. When my daughter was in year 2 or 3, so primary, what age is that? 7, 8, 6. No, younger than that. 6, 7, I don't know. I remember the teacher speaking to me because she was struggling with maths. This is before we even knew that she was neurodivergent. She's struggling with maths. And the teacher said one of the issues that's, you know, the whole class is struggling with is that what I taught them last year in year one, because it was the same teacher, what I taught them last year in year one was the standard. And we, you know, we did everything we needed to do for year one. But overnight, like over the summer holidays, the government had decided that they want all year twos to be at year three level. So in year two, I've got to teach them year two and year three maths. And I was like, why? Mm-hmm. And this seems to have continued. I mean, my daughter's 16 now, but I still hear this all the time. Oh, you know, when they're bringing home homework, that's like, what? Like, I didn't do this till secondary.
Yeah, the system keeps like getting, the expectations keep getting higher and higher, don't they? And just to pick up on what you were saying about, you know, how you believe that there are changes that could be made for children with education, health and care plans that would sort of make things better for everyone. I think that's, we've been seeing parallels across all areas. So when we talk about what schools are doing for children from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, or what children are doing for what schools are doing for children with particular needs, or, you know, what schools are doing to celebrate particular cultural backgrounds, like those things benefit all pupils, but they're such small pockets at the moment compared to that real shift in just making education inclusive by design, you know, for pupils with SEND, for black and brown kids, for kids from deprived areas. That's, you know, if we could just think, well, how does education work for these pupils, would get it right for everyone. And the other thing that really struck me when you were speaking is how little value we place on parents when we talk about education in this country. You know, you're absolutely right that parents are often blamed. You know, we're not seeing the impact, but our project did some work with parents of black children in Bristol, and they were able to articulate exactly what their children need. And, you know, from that, we were very easily able to produce a report which said, these are the things that children need. And, you know, I guess what you're echoing is that parents know the solutions. And those barriers are those accountability systems within education, which, like you said, are leaving teachers absolutely broken, and they're leaving the profession. But then when our children opt out, it's not the system that's held to account. It's them and their parents, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for me, this just all boils down to that stigma and marginalisation. Like, we, as neurodivergent people, as parents of neurodivergent kids, and then if you've got intersectionality, that you're black or brown, or you're queer, or, you know, you come from a deprived area, all of that then just compounds. Like, I am privileged in that I'm white, and I have I have a level of education, yet still, as a parent, when I sit in tribunal, I have been, and even before tribunal, in terms of when my children were assessed, I have been blamed. I have been blamed for being overly anxious or, I mean, it's written even in one of my kids' reports that I am, that I was not allowing him to go to school. And I'm sat there and I'm going, I at the time I lived opposite the primary school where he was on roll. And every single morning I watched all the parents, and he did, walk past with their kids, drop their kids off, and then go and do whatever they wanted to do, whether that be work or pleasure or shopping or whatever, and then go pick them up at 3 o'clock. And as much as what I didn't resent my child at all for that, like, I wanted to say to them, don't you think that that would be really lovely for me? Like, don't you think that I could work more, blah, blah, blah. I could have some rest time. I've gone off slightly on a tangent, but that stigma and marginalisation and discrimination is rife within that system. I've worked with parents, with mothers who, can't remember who that was that told me this, whether I've heard it on another train or from Kieran Rose, the autistic advocate, I can't remember. But there was a mother of an SEN child that basically found a man, single parent, found a man to take, like, I'm sure he just wasn't a complete random man off the street, to take into a meeting because as a mum, as a female in that environment, it's like, and you see it drives me mad, written in reports, mum reports, mum's, mum, in one of my kids' report, mum's hypothesis. And I'm like, so you've got that gender inequality as well. That's just massive. And the whole just mum stuff is horrendous. I had a bit of a rant about this the other day, actually, about this whole sort of link between people, and I don't know if I get the term right, people that fall into our lower social economic status category. And because I was having this conversation with a parent and about this marginalization, and I was like, hang on a minute, if we are late discovered neurodivergent people who have been also failed by a system historically, that education hasn't necessarily met our needs, and we haven't been successful in education, and we have suffered health inequalities, and all of that discrimination unknowingly, and we have ended up as a result in a lower SES class or status or whatever the term is. Mm-hmm. Because we are neurodivergent, and then we end up with, we then have a family and we have neurodivergent kids, again, unknowingly. Yet in these areas, in some of these areas within our schools, within these areas, there's not enough awareness of that link between actually we are more likely to be neurodivergent in those areas. So therefore, we're more likely to have neurodivergent kids. But in those areas, parent blame is rife. So this parent was saying, well, you know, in this school that she was trying to do some work in, and saying, you know, this child is potentially neurodivergent. They're like, well, it's because, he's not neurodivergent. It's because dad's in prison. Well, actually, dad's potentially in prison because he's neurodivergent. and with unmet needs and been failed and whatever else. So nobody's making these links. So then this child is not getting the right approach or the right understanding or the right framework around him because, well, he's like that because dad's in prison.
And there's so much research out there which, you know, explores some of this in terms of, you know, the number of children who are known to the youth offending service who have special educational needs, the number of people in prison who have literacy difficulties. But this kind of that research seems to sit out here on a limb and isn't kind of brought into the mainstream. You know, when we talk about research in schools, it tends to be, what's the best way to ask children questions? And what's the best way to sequence a lesson and a unit of learning? And less so much so focused on, you know, some of the intersections that you've talked about. And yeah, I don't think I've ever heard anyone speak before about that link between neurodivergence and class, and, you know, how schools in those areas are likely to have higher levels of neurodivergent kids. And so they should be set up to work for higher numbers of neurodivergent kids, shouldn't they?
There's still so much focus on behaviour and behaviourist approaches. So these kids are still in these, particularly within these communities, these kids are still being just deemed the naughty kids. So what are we going to put in place? Are we going to put in place behaviour charts and reports and, you know, and making them sit still on the carpet with their hands in their laps without anybody recognising actually this kid's potentially got sensory needs and, you know, executive functioning challenges, and actually this child is communicating distress. It's just one of the very nuanced aspects of frustration, to be honest, with the education system.
Who is allowed to communicate distress is sort of a whole podcast episode in itself, isn't it? You know, the ways in which certain people's distress is listened to, but, you know, it's dismissed in so many sections of the population as, you know, and blame is overlaid instead. And I think, you know, we see that black and brown parents talk about that with regards to racism, and, you know, we've got neurodivergent parents and parents of neurodivergent kids feeling that blame and shame, and you know, yeah, it intersects with class. And it's, yeah, you've really got me thinking today about the ways in which we view parents within the system. And it'd be interesting to explore that further, I think. And, you know, part of our research, we do talk to parents, and it's interesting that we get parents turning up to some of our sessions who don't often turn up to parents' coffee mornings. You know, the schools say to us, oh, I haven't seen those parents come before. So, you know, it's great that they've come in to participate in your research. And there must be a reason for that. I think there's a real kind of breakdown of trust sometimes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's a massive breakdown of trust and fear. Again, it's sort of that intersectionality between the communities that you come from, stigma, marginalization, and speaking out. So if you are speaking out, if you are asked to go into a system and speak out against it, if you fall into one of those stigmatized communities, you're not necessarily safe. And it's a really fine balance to play, because, you know, when I'm working with parents and supporting them to advocate and empowering them, there's also this massive part of that actually, and I see this all the time in my work, when parents stand up to the system and when they say, no, I'm not forcing my child into school, no, I am going to insist that you listen to me as a parent, as the advocate for my child, referrals go into social care all the time. It's frightening, because we do know that, you know, and there's loads of research into this, and sort of a separate topic of itself, but all intertwined, is the levels of parent blame and FII and fabricated and induced illness, and children falsely being removed from the care of their neurodivergent parents is a risk. And I cannot pretend, I have to acknowledge that when I'm working with neurodivergent parents of neurodivergent kids, and say, actually, you know, we know this is what your child needs, but we need to advocate safely. And I work with lots of parents that agree to services and interventions that actually they know will not work for their child and potentially compound their child's trauma. Yet if they say they can't say no, because if they say no, they're at risk of blocking.
Yeah. And conversely, you know, what schools are saying to us is that the thresholds for social care are just so high. So we've got this kind of double problem where, you know, one group is being seen as needing referral to social care when we've got children who, you know, we are really concerned or at real risk of harm, aren't able to access the care, you know, the level of support that they need. So it's, I guess, I think I want to ask you now, given kind of everything we've talked about, is there anything in the system that gives you hope or things that are working well?
Yeah, I mean, every time I deliver a piece of training to a school and get feedback that's like, that's really made us think, anytime that I have professionals reach out to me asking, like teachers, school staff reaching out to me asking questions about students, I'm like, yes, this is amazing. But a big thing that I'm a big advocate for as well is our alternative provision community. Like, we have got some immense alternative provisions. There is a but to that, in that accessing them and funding for them is a challenge. But I think if we can look at our alternative provisions, and if we can start putting some really nice evidence-based research that's coming from them, and looking at how to get it right. And we focus so much on what is going wrong, but there are pockets of things going really, really well. But we need that to be filtered into policy and filtered into government. We have to accept that the school system doesn't work for all kids, and that there is an alternative, but we need to make that alternative accessible. I love working with alternative provisions and seeing kids thrive within those environments. It's really joyful. There are some incredible SENCOs, teachers, schools that are trying so hard to raise the voices, and they are listening to parents, and there are parent carer forums who are doing incredible work. I work a lot with parent carer forums, and there's been some money called the PINS project, PINS funding, I can't remember what PINS stands for now, that's been put out to parent carer forums, and it's basically trying to increase inclusivity in schools. So there's pockets of funding that's coming forwards that is giving parent carer forums weight and empowerment. Our parent carer forums are brilliant because, like, particularly the local one that I work with a lot, they are well in with some of the powers that be, and they have a voice within those boards and panels and forums. And their parents that have that lived experience and specialist insight into what not only is it like for a parent, but also, you know, some insight into what their children experience and the challenges face there as well. There is, like, I'm really privileged that I get to supervise some brilliant research as well, being done by autistic people, by autistic trainees and students, that is looking at the experiences of neurodivergent kids. And a really incredible piece of research that I'm involved with a trainee clinical psychologist who's looked at the experience of parents of autistic kids, and I can't wait for that to sort of be finalized and published, because the richness of the data and everything we've talked about, the breaking down of trust, the fear of advocating for your child, the education system as a whole, is all within there. It's massive, and it can go off in so many different directions. But there are some brilliant, passionate academics, researchers that this is a big focus for, because they have that personal experience and they have made it out the other end, and they want to use their experiences to inform best practice.
Brilliant.
So yeah, there's lots of pockets. There's lots of exciting, joyful pockets, which you know, we have to hold on to, don't we? So
we do, and that's great. And I think that brings us nicely onto our final question, which is the same for all guests on the podcast. What would a just education system look like to you?
In a nutshell, I would like. Okay, so if I was to put this really, really in a nutshell, I would like an education system that trusted kids. Mm. I think generally, societally, we don't trust kids. I don't think we trust kids to make good choices for themselves and for other people. I don't think we give our kids enough autonomy. I think we are still quite Victorian sometimes in our views or our approaches to children, and we don't. It's all about control, and if you're not controlling your child, you're not a good enough parent. And if a teacher isn't controlling the class, she's not a good enough teacher. I pride myself on having, I want to use the word feral, but not in a negative way, feral children, but my children have an awful lot of autonomy, and that works for us. I work with lots of burnt out young people who I constantly am saying to services, give them autonomy, trust that they will when they can, trust them to make their own choices about what feels safe, what doesn't feel safe. Our kids have completely lost touch and disconnected with what they feel about what feels good and what doesn't feel good, because they're constantly told when they can eat, when they can go to the toilet, what they can learn, how they can learn it. And it feels like this containment of our kids is causing a lot of the issues that we're seeing societally with, you know, all of this out of control kids. Well, actually, these kids are just desperate to feel in control of their own lives. I love Dr. Luke Bearden's analogy of saying that the education system is upside down for autistic kids, where if we gave, and I think this is the same for all kids, but if we gave kids, all kids, but particularly autistic kids, autonomy to hyper-focus and have control and trust over what they choose to learn and how they choose to learn it, which is what we are allowed to do at PhD level, then gradually things would, knowledge, insight, interest, curiosity would just naturally broaden. But we don't have a system that allows kids to learn through exploration and experientially and hyper-focus on interests. And I think that's a real shame. When I see that happening, when I work with kids through school trauma and burnout, where we do give autonomy, I see the most incredible the most incredible outcomes and the most incredible creativity and authenticity and joyfulness in learning. And our kids have lost a love for learning because they're told what to do and how to do it. And I think, yeah, trust and autonomy in education is, and obviously in order for that to happen, the structure of it needs to look different.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's so interesting. I'm just reflecting on all of the people I know, you know, the adults I know who had really poor experiences of school and did, you know, really badly if you judge them by the way that the system judges outcomes, but then have gone on to succeed in higher education and careers in a, you know, really big way because they've been allowed to focus on that one thing that really matters to them. And yeah, that's a fascinating idea of flipping it. So yeah, I'm going to sit with that one for a while and think about it.
It is something that I have the privilege to see when I work with kids that have left, not even left, been forced out of the system. And we need those brains. We really do need those brains in terms of our diversity of of humans. We need all of that. And equally, yes, if you look at our entrepreneurs, and I'm not going to mention all of them, but our entrepreneurs haven't, most of them haven't followed a typical path. And just to end, because I will talk forever, talking about, you said about if we measured everybody with this, or we measured the people you know with this idea of success, we need to completely reframe what success looks like, because it feels at the moment that we are measuring kids up against what the government wants. And for me, it all comes back down to money and people who are productive financially. And that's really damaging for all people.
Yeah, and that's something, that answer has figured in so many of these final questions, you know, in terms of accountability measures or outcomes, or, yeah, it's something that I think there's a lot of frustration with in the system. And hopefully, you know, in time, that will start to shift. But I think it's going to take a lot to get there. But thank you so much, JD, for talking to me today. It's been a really great conversation.
No, thank you for having me. It was nice to be invited.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Repair Ed podcast. Please take a listen to our other episodes, and if you'd like to be a guest, get in touch. Our email can be found on our website, www.repair-ed.uk.